Dan Parati knew for a long time that he was going to die. I guess we all do. But Dan, he really knew. In 1988, when he was 59, a valve in Dan's heart collapsed.
Since then, I've never been given what you would call a clean bill of health. The diagnosis is that I have congestive heart failure. Now I've got a fancy pacemaker with a defibrillator in it and so on. I can hear the valve clicking all the time.
That's Dan in 2012, more than a year before I met him. He was talking to Judy, his wife, who was recording his life story in their living room in Madison.
Dan, when and where were you born?
I was born at 33 and a half Park Avenue, Kane, Pennsylvania, on October 27, 1929. I was born at home, in the very bed that you and I slept in at one time.
In those interviews, Dan told story after story about his long, full life, about growing up in the Allegheny Mountains during the Depression, becoming a Lutheran minister, and later deciding to leave the church. He talked about marching in Selma with Martin Luther King Jr., about preaching to a packed congregation in Queens after JFK's assassination. In middle age, he launched a second career, helping small cities renovate old theaters across America. Along the way, he was married twice and had seven kids.
I've always had a kind of holy mackerel idea, feeling about my life. You know, this skinny little kid from Kane, Pennsylvania. And here I am with seven children, six grandchildren, living a very comfortable life. It's really rather amazing.
When he was a minister, Dan buried hundreds of people. In a way, death became just another part of the job. But he told Judy that his first lesson about death came as a kid, when his dog was hit by a car.
Sport was with the family before I was born. And when I was young enough to see over the top of the enamel table in the kitchen, Sport was hit by a car out on Park Avenue. And Dad brought Sport in and laid him gently down on the enamel table and stroked him and just kind of was with him until he died. And I have that image of my father. Not much said, but he took care of Sport.
Nearly 80 years later, when Judy asked her husband about his own death, Dan was matter of fact.
Death doesn't bother me anyway. It's part of life, and I don't even think I worry about that. I'm not looking forward to it, but I certainly don't care.
You spent many years preaching about God. How do you envision God today?
I don't. That's not true. The problem I have with that question is that whenever anyone asks you, do you believe in God, they've already got something in their head they're talking about, whatever the image is that they've got. They never have the right image. You know, I'm enough of a scientist, or have enough interest in science, to understand that you can't destroy matter. It becomes something else. It becomes energy. Can't destroy energy. It becomes something else. And that's what I am. I'm just a bunch of matter and energy put together in a certain way.
Do you believe in an afterlife?
No. Whatever I am, all this energy and mass and stuff, becomes something else. Maybe I'll be a tree.
Do you think that's what you'll be?
I have no idea.
If you had your choice, what would you like to be? Oh.
Nothing in this world, because I've done this. I don't know. It's just some energy floating around, doing something.
I met Dan Parati in September of 2013, when he was 83 years old and stuck in a wheelchair. A clicking pacemaker in his chest kept his heart going, but he and his wife, Judy, were dealing with the fact that his medical options had pretty much run out.
I made the decision that I didn't want to continue just sort of living on the edge and in the hospital, out of the hospital, a burden on everybody. And
you signed a DNR.
Yeah, you know, I'm in the stage of being pretty much content with the decision to prepare to die rather than to fight to stay alive.
A month later, I was sitting with Dan and Judy at their dining room table. The autumn sun was shining through their windows, but by then, Dan didn't leave their home much. He needed help doing just about everything, getting dressed, combing his hair. I asked him how he was doing.
Yeah, how do you feel today?
Pretty good.
Yeah.
Pretty good.
What's pretty good?
It means that I'm sitting up here. I had breakfast. I had help getting dressed. And I'm not out of breath, particularly.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I want to stay up and function for a while today, anyway.
Yeah. I was thinking of, you can get that, sure, it's fine.
Hold on just a second.
No problem.
Hi, Shannon.
Hospice nurses stopped by regularly to help Judy and Dan.
Oh, and you're coming on Thursday? Okay, and do you know about what time? Okay, yeah, that's perfect. Wait, Dan is saying, what do you need?
We're a little bit concerned about the tube or the catheter.
Can you wait till Thursday?
Yeah.
Dan said that he's a little concerned about the tube and the catheter, so can you take a look at that on Thursday? Okay, fabulous. See you then. Thank you. Bye. Yeah, that's the hospice call I was waiting for. Sorry.
Oh.
Yeah.
They weren't seeing doctors anymore. There wasn't much the doctors could do for Dan.
Are you on a lot of medications?
Yeah, I am.
Dumb question, I guess. I see that. Oh, yeah, the pill box over there.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. Today is Tuesday, so we'll open up Wednesday.
Each day, he was taking 10 pills in the morning.
That's Wednesday morning.
Four more at night.
14.
Goodness.
Yeah.
Are you on any pain medication?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That doesn't count. So wait a minute. So it's 14 plus 3 plus 3. So it's 20. 20 pills a day.
By February, things were worse. One night, Dan fell out of his bed and broke his shoulder. His kidneys were failing too, and that wasn't just a problem for his physical health.
The kidneys are not able to filter out the toxins that are going to his brain, and so there are many times that he's quite lucid, and there are other times that he is not. He sees things that aren't there.
Elephants this week.
Elephants. You saw elephants.
Seeing.
A couple weeks ago, you had black bugs crawling all over you. So, you know, he's hallucinating from time to time. Other times he's totally with it and cracking jokes. So his decision to think about dying in the next month is a decision that he's making, I think, with all of his faculties intact.
I don't know. Do you think you're ready to do that?
Yeah, I am ready to do it.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of shutting it all down.
Mm-hmm.
It's an experience that's growing on me and slower than I thought it might be.
What is?
The process of dying.
Is there any part of you that welcomes death?
Sure. I'm tired. And I don't know if welcome is the right word, but yeah. So in a way, I'm kind of interested to see how this is going to go. You know, what's going to happen next? I had this crazy vision one night when I was lying in bed that you could put a microphone in the casket. Well, you're laughing.
What would I hear?
Well, that's what we don't know.
Oh, I see. Oh.
But you could, even if it were just a grunt, you know.
that would definitely make the news.
Yes, you know, I think I must have been wondering, well, what would I say? What am I going to say when I'm in my casket? And then I'll, of course, realize that I won't be able to say anything because my vocal cords are going to deteriorate.
Maybe that's not the only reason you would be able to say anything.
Yeah.
Such a big decision, you know. This is a decision of life and death, and there's waffling, you know. I asked you the other day, and I said, "What do you look forward to every day?"
Yeah.
Do you remember what you said?
Yeah.
The snow. It's not a lot, but it still gives him pleasure. Mm-hmm. So I guess, what is that tipping point when there isn't even the snow?
The snow is melting.
The snow is melting.
Dan had been living with congestive heart failure for 25 years. Last winter, it was taking a lot of pills and a pacemaker just to keep him alive. And as his health got worse, his quality of life was going with it. He and his wife, Judy, started wondering if he should just stop taking his medication. It was, literally, a life or death decision.
He turned inward more and more and more. And we would sit and have a meal together, and He hardly spoke. He just didn't have it in him anymore. The hospice doctors and the pastor, they were all asking him questions, but I don't know that they asked him the right question. They were saying to him, "Are you afraid of death?" And he was very emphatically saying, "No, I'm not afraid of death." And he wasn't. That night, I sat at the end of the bed and I said, "I know you've said you're not afraid of death." And then I said, "Are you afraid of dying?" And he said, "Yes, I'm afraid of dying." And I asked him what it was that frightened him, and he said, "The unknown and the process of dying and probably the discomfort in dying." And so we talked about that. I promised him that he would never be uncomfortable to the extent that we would use everything in our powers to keep him comfortable, and that I wouldn't leave his side, that I would be there and walk with him through this process. And I think it was shortly after that that he made the decision to stop the medication. He spoke with the doctor about going off the medications, and the doctor indicated to him that he thought if and when Dan went off the medications, he probably would not live for very long, a couple of days to a week. And Dan made the decision then to go off the drugs that day, right here at this table. "I'm done. No more pills." That was it. And on that Monday, on the 10th, now he'd been off for 10, 11 days off the medications, and he woke up that morning and he was very uncomfortable. So I gave him a double dose of morphine right away. And an hour later, he was still very uncomfortable. So I gave him a second double dose of morphine. And our hospice nurse, Shannon, called and said, "How's it going?" And I said, "I can't control the pain." And she said, "All right, we're going to put him into the IPU, the inpatient unit." And we knew he could hear us, but he was just not responding. He was smiling every once in a while, but that was all. And our dear friend, Jim Murphy, walked in, and Jim has always walked in wherever Dan has been and kissed Dan on the top of his head, and Dan has always rolled his eyes. I watched his face when Jim went over to him and kissed him, and he couldn't roll his eyes anymore, but you could see that he was trying to. And then Jim said, "Hey, Dan'l, I've got a great joke. Can I tell you a joke?" And Dan said, "No." And that was his last word. That was it. By Tuesday, he had slipped into a coma. So we were talking to him, but we never felt that release, because he was...
he was fighting this. He was fighting dying. And the doctor that we saw on Monday, she said, maybe we should talk about turning off his pacemaker if this is something that you want. And I said, absolutely. I mean, Dan had been in a deep coma for about 5 days. So Medtronic was on its way over, but he died before they got there. We were all there with him. 4 kids. We were all holding on to him. Just holding on to him. And we were crying. It was very sad, but it was very beautiful because he knew we were there. I mean, as much as he could know, and they say that hearing is the last thing to go, we were all talking to him. We were telling him we loved him. And he just took his last breath, and then he was gone. It was so simple, and it was very beautiful. And he was gone.
Is there any part of you that welcomes death?
Sure. I'm tired. So in a way, I'm kind of interested to see how this is going to go. You know, what's going to happen next.
Dan died on March 17th, 2014. His wife and kids were with him. The funeral was 2 days later.
I arranged with the help of dear friends to have people sit with Dan's body, day and night, from the time he arrived at the funeral home until the time the funeral started. It was snowing in the morning. Dan would have loved the snow. And then when we got to the Farley Center, the sun came out. And I thought, this is perfect. A little sunshine, a little snow. He would have loved it. We wanted it simple. There weren't flowers there. There weren't boards with photos. There was nothing. It was just the spoken word.
What you may not know, and what I can share with you, is what it was like to be raised by such a man. He was gentle enough to comfort through mere contact. And he was always encouraging, even in my strangest pursuits. I think that is because he was confident in me. Confident that my character would prevail, a character that I can attribute to him. What he taught me through his examples are ideals that we strive for as a humanity. And I was lucky enough to have them embodied in my father.
Dan was buried in what's known as a green cemetery. There was no embalming, no headstones, no concrete vaults. The pallbearers carried Dan's plain pine casket up a soggy hill to a wooded site. They lowered Dan into a 4-foot deep hole. It was Judy who shoveled the first scoop of earth into her husband's grave.
The dirt, yeah. Then it's final. There's no coming back from any of it, but just the first shovelful of dirt that hits that coffin is just like, that's very hard to hear, very hard to experience. And it was hard because the grandchildren were there and none of them had seen their grandfather at hospice. We wanted to protect them from that. And we didn't want them to remember him like that, in a coma. So they were at the funeral and they were very sad at the funeral, but I think it really hit them when we buried him. And they were really very upset, just sobbing. because they too understood that this was it. This was the end.
I've always had a kind of holy mackerel idea, feeling about my life. You know, this little kid from, skinny little kid from Kane, Pennsylvania. And here I am with 7 children, 6 grandchildren, living a very comfortable life. It's really rather amazing.
I only knew Dan 6 months, but before he died, I learned that he was a funny, generous guy who adored his wife, Judy. After his funeral was over and the guests were gone, Judy went home to a pile of paperwork, condolence cards, and solitude. I stopped by a couple of weeks later to see how she was doing.
Seth, there's a big part that feels relief. I had 8 months to prepare for this, 8 months to mourn. Dan was slipping away, and I was worried about feeling lonely, and I have not felt lonely. And there are times that, you know, I wish I could share things with him. He had an incredible memory, and somebody asked me something recently, and I thought, oh, too bad Dan's not here because he'd know the answer and I can't remember. You know, those family stories, except for the ones that I recorded, all of that is gone now.
2 years earlier, Judy had recorded Dan talking about his life, about working as a Lutheran minister, about leaving the church, about being a father. They also talked about his death. And what would come after it?
How would you like to be remembered by your family and your friends?
Family, I would like them to remember me the way I remember my father. You know, with love and happiness that they knew me. Friends, I hope they remember me for my sense of humor and constancy. I worry about you, by the way, about it.
You want to say more about that?
Yeah, I think that you exhaust yourself and you don't think about that.
When I stopped by, Judy was just getting off the phone with a credit card company, arguing over some of Dan's accounts. Her to-do list was on the kitchen counter, and it was long. But when I asked her how she was doing, she said that she'd slept in that morning, and she was planning vacations that she never could have taken while Dan was sick. She was doing okay, and she was working on remembering Dan when he was in his prime.
I have a lot of energy, but the Dan that I first met, I couldn't keep up with the guy. And that's the Dan that I want to remember. You know, he was playful and whimsical, and I don't know, when I met him, I don't think the man had a savings account, because that he never cared about money. And, you know, the interesting thing is that after he died, and the children wanted something to remember him by. And I said, well, go through his dresser. Take whatever you want. Do you know that all they found were handkerchiefs?
Oh, no.
That's what they each took. They took a handkerchief. The man had nothing, which is so appropriate in so many ways.
That's how Dan was. He wasn't worried about where his stuff would end up after he died. As for where he'd end up, well, Dan kind of thought he'd be everywhere.
I believe that when I'm buried, dead and buried, whatever I am, all this energy and mass and stuff, becomes something else. Just some energy floating around.
So I asked Judy, what does she think happens to us after we die? Where do you think Dan is now?
Oh, this is a question I've struggled with my entire adult life, and I still don't have an answer. I too believe that we can't totally disappear. So there's something there. But I'm still grappling with that. I don't know. Oh, I feel his presence a lot. I mean, just look around the house and he's everywhere. I feel his absence. I feel both his presence and his absence. Yeah.